UAB Medcast is an ongoing medical education podcast. The UAB Division of Continuing Education designates that each episode of this enduring material is worth a maximum of 0.25 AMA PRA Category 1 credit. To collect credit, please visit uabmedicine.org/medcast and complete the episode's post-test.
Welcome to UAB Medcast, a continuing education podcast for medical professionals. Bringing knowledge to your world, here's Melanie Cole.
Bronchiectasis is a condition where the bronchial tubes of your lungs are permanently damaged or enlarged, and is considered the common endpoint of various disorders that cause chronic airway inflammation, and it may affect many areas of the lung. My guest today is Dr. Marty Solomon. He's an assistant professor of medicine in the Division of Pulmonary, Allergy, and Critical Care Medicine at UAB Medicine. Welcome to the show, Dr. Solomon. What is bronchiectasis?
Oh, thanks for having me. Bronchiectasis is a clinical condition that is actually defined by a radiographic appearance of dilation and damage to the medium-sized airways in the lungs, and is oftentimes associated with a lot of other conditions, as you mentioned, as a leading etiology for the condition. And so we oftentimes see patients that are actually having the symptoms of bronchiectasis, which include a mucopurulent or a productive cough, as well as shortness of breath with exertion or at rest, and as well as recurrent pulmonary infections that may be related to sinus infections as well.
So let's talk about the epidemiology. Who's at risk for this?
Yeah, so it's actually an interesting question you ask. The risk factors for bronchiectasis in the absence of a known condition that leads to that, like a common condition that's known to do that, like cystic fibrosis, are not well known, unfortunately. So the patient at risk for that, it's not well known. Much of the bronchiectasis that we think is secondary to early infections in life, and so it's been postulated that maybe people that have early infections in life are more at risk for bronchiectasis, but the condition is so understudied at this point, we don't really know perfectly who has risk factors for the condition.
What about GERD or weakened immune systems? Do any of those contribute?
Totally. There are several types of immune dysfunction. The most common are the various forms of inherited or acquired immunoglobulin deficiencies, which are associated with a mild form of bronchiectasis. The association of, you asked about gastroesophageal reflux disease, or GERD, that is an association with bronchiectasis. We don't yet know if it's causative or not. There is postulation in our basic science literature and some clinical literature that, in fact, that may be the case. But whether or not that's a known definitive cause is not known at this present time. We do know that it may exacerbate the symptoms of bronchiectasis, and so we treat it as a modality, but we don't yet know if it's causative or not.
So what's the most accurate modality for diagnosis?
Well, to make the diagnosis of bronchiectasis, it requires a clinical suspicion based on the symptoms I outlined for you a few moments ago, but the definitive diagnosis is only made by what's called a high-resolution computed tomography scan of the lungs. That's more commonly referred to as the high-res CAT scan or CT of the lungs.
So what is the high-res CT showing you?
Right. So the high-res CT is a modality which takes ultra-thin, high-definition type images of the lungs. So it's essentially like taking very thin X-rays through and through the lungs and then adding them up, summing them through a radiographic technique to make what would almost look like an old flipbook movie of the lungs. And because they're so thin, we get a lot of detail about the airways themselves, and we can actually pick up this dilation and thickening of the airways in an accurate fashion. Other CT modalities, or magnetic resonance imaging, or commonly known as MRI, or standard chest X-ray or regular X-ray imaging, is not sensitive enough at present to make the firm diagnosis. Those are being studied, but are not sensitive enough at present to make the diagnosis. So the diagnosis is dependent upon this high-resolution CAT scan or CT imaging.
What are some of your treatment options for bronchiectasis?
It's a good question. Unfortunately, we don't have a lot of FDA-approved therapies based on a relative paucity of literature in this field, although because of the rising incidence and the rising recognition of the disease across the world, really, there has been some study of various treatment modalities, and they're aimed at symptom control and reduction of flares, or what we call a bronchiectasis exacerbation. And so those therapies generally revolve around dealing with the mucus. The body's response to this inflammation ongoing in the lungs is that it produces extra mucus, which traps infection and also causes a lot of the symptoms, because the mucus traps the airways and causes damage to the airways and also tightness and whatnot, which makes the patient symptomatic. So our therapies are aimed at clearing this mucus and thinning it. And we use mucolytic therapies. The most common one that I use is a therapy called hypertonic saline, which actually helps to hydrate and thin mucus and stimulate cough to expel the mucus out of the small airways. In addition, we use mechanical devices, including chest physiotherapy vests or other devices, which help to generate flow in the lungs and help to further expel this mucus so it does not trap infections and gives the patient some relief of symptoms. In addition, we fight significantly against infections, both chronically and acutely. And so on the chronic front, there's been a lot of study in the medical literature looking at various types of antibiotics, either rotational oral antibiotics or prophylactic antibiotics, one of those being the macro antibiotic called azithromycin, and it's been shown to reduce exacerbation rates if patients take that therapy on an ongoing basis. Now, on the acute side, we focus on trying to identify what pathogens or microbes are causing the infection and target those in a very sophisticated fashion. We also look at the use of inhalational antibiotics, which have been studied extensively both in the bronchiectasis called cystic fibrosis bronchiectasis and then the other form called non-cystic fibrosis bronchiectasis. And therein, there is a difference in that the patients with cystic fibrosis type bronchiectasis tend to have very promising responses to various inhalational antibiotics for treating common infections that infect patients with bronchiectasis like Pseudomonas aeruginosa. Unfortunately, those studies have not fleshed out to be as promising in the non-CF bronchiectasis realm. So because of that, we have to use a case-by-case basis, and that's part of what motivates needing an experienced physician that can think through those case scenarios of who's going to be the patient to attempt this off-label type therapy with.
Dr. Solomon, what about children?
Yep,
are children if they get vaccinated for flu, pertussis, measles, that sort of thing, is that going to reduce their risk? Is vaccination involved?
It does. Certainly childhood infections, we think, may drive bronchiectasis, and there is some literature, especially the reduction of pertussis rates is probably helping bronchiectasis in subsequent generations, as that's known to be a tight association of that recurrent infection with pertussis and development of bronchiectasis later. That won't help the current older generations in our society, but it will potentially help, you know, the younger kids who have been exposed to, you know, to recurrent pertussis vaccination in the last few decades. That said, there are several conditions in children which cause congenital bronchiectasis, including conditions that enlarge the trachea and bronchial cartilage, as well as genetic conditions like primary ciliary dyskinesia, which is a genetic condition that causes the cilia, which propel mucus naturally out of the lungs and trachea, not to work properly, as well as cystic fibrosis and some other related conditions, all of which are genetic. So there are congenital and genetic conditions that, despite our, you know, our kind of public health efforts, are not going to prevent all bronchiectasis, even in children, unfortunately.
Dr. Solomon, more common post-infective bronchiectasis from necrotizing bacterial pneumonia or staph or pertussis, as we mentioned, can this be prevented? What are you prophylactically recommending to prevent it?
Yeah, it's a vexing problem we have, and I don't know that there at present we have a public health strategy for preventing it. It's a rare disease, and so at this point, without knowing all the known risk factors, you know, to do an elaborate prevention strategy for the few patients that are going to have a necrotizing pneumonia and going to have bronchiectasis is not necessarily feasible at this point. That said, if a patient begins to display, you know, does have a severe pneumonia and they have a recurrence of that, I think it's worthy of considering the diagnosis of bronchiectasis so we can begin to consider therapies for that patient early rather than letting their course get out of whack down the line and then sacrificing lung function and or, you know, quality of life for a long period of time.
And in just the last few minutes, tell us about your team. Why is UAB so great to work with?
Well, UAB is a highly collaborative center, and we value the multidisciplinary approach to patient care, and we also really value taking care of patients, and we have a lot of resources here that can help the patient significantly. So my team is made up of experienced respiratory therapists that provide education and training on devices for patients, experienced pulmonary nurse practitioners as well as pulmonary nurse coordinators, and an excellent general clinic staff that are accustomed to pulmonary patients. In addition, that's complemented by an inpatient pulmonary floor in our hospital which has dedicated staff that are cross-trained in the complex pulmonary patient from the terms of respiratory therapy as well as nursing. And we have an excellent set of physicians here who are well-experienced and are involved in expanding the medical literature. So I think we have the type of team that's needed for a difficult and challenging patient like this to provide either longitudinal care or consultative care for the patient for this difficult problem.
Thank you so much for being with us today, Dr. Solomon. You're listening to UAB Medcast. For more information on resources available at UAB Medicine, you can go to uabmedicine.org/physician. That's uabmedicine.org/physician. This is Melanie Cole. Thanks so much for listening.